Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your favorite Gemini ascendant and former LARPer, Mikala Ann. Every D&D player knows that all parties are more fun when they include a good bard. Mythos building and storytelling are one of the most basic skills that makes human consciousness so interesting. All social customs are built from myth, but as Mercury in their guise of trickster will teach you, creating new myths is one of the best ways to subvert and redirect customs and social order. With that consideration in mind, I invited C.R. Sanders, otherwise known as Chris, onto the podcast to discuss the book he is currently writing, a memoir on magic and misadventure. Chris has been the Hollywood go-to guy for production of esoteric and paranormal content for the past 25 years. He is a seasoned and devoted magical practitioner for over two decades, with past affiliations and leadership roles in multiple occult orders and societies. Over the past decade, Chris has become much more attentive to tracking patterns of progress and echoes of divine voices through various times and spaces and mediums. Now, in true mercurial fashion, he is sharing his adventures and misadventures with us, demonstrating and imparting the wisdom of folly and the joy of mercurial magic and bravery. If you find this podcast interesting and want to show some support, consider checking out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/saturnvox. I can also be found on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Saturnvox.
Hi there. Let me tell you how much of a joy it is to be here on your podcast. We're doing it in the hour of Saturn, very appropriately, on the day of Mars, as Saturn and Mars are joining and having their fun little push-pull dance.
Oh my gosh, and we're both Cancer Marses over here being extremely brave doing this recording right now.
Yeah. And, you know, today we're going to be talking about astro magic. We're going to be talking about magic in the media. And we're going to talk about my approach to all this, which is essentially the joys of misadventure. And I just want to touch on how this has been very much a misadventure in various ways, doing this podcast. And part of that is being brave and pushing through it, and having the courage to not let hiccups or roadblocks or obstacles prevent you from doing things.
Yeah, because we've actually tried to record this episode now, what, three times?
I think this is the third. This is the third, so it's the charm.
Yeah, it takes three times to do anything right.
Yeah, so it's our lucky day. And Venus has entered Pisces, right? This morning. So hopefully everyone woke up today feeling more beautiful and lovely and creative and all that good stuff. Yeah. I have Venus in Aries and it's in my fourth house. And Rahu has recently gone into Aries, which is a whole thing. And of course, I'm dealing with all these sort of domestic issues right now that I'm not going to really get into here, but it's just also appropriate. And it's one of the things that I want to converse with you about on this podcast, which we have conversed about, you know, person to person before, which is how when you start plugging into these cycles of time and energy and planetary, both figures and movements, they really just start bouncing back and reflecting you constantly. And I find that I've been doing like a planetary prayer exercise for a good 8 years, I think. That do it every morning. And when I started doing that, yeah, all that dialed up so much. It's really incredible. And one thing I want to talk about as well is we see so many magical practitioners, or I really want to say people interested in magic these days with social media and with Neptune in Pisces. We have a whole generation of people who were raised on Harry Potter. And I'm just using that as one example, but I think that's a really apt example of a whole generation of people who believe in magic, but I'm not so sure they necessarily know how to practice it that well. Because in movies and such, magic has always sort of been displayed as this kind of like you wave a wand and click, you know, things poof, they happen. And we as practitioners know that that's not necessarily how it works. Sometimes it does, but usually it's something that sort of bleeds into your whole life. And it's a process and not an event. So I think one thing I've found myself doing is speaking to a lot of people that are about 20 years younger than me who are where I was at 20 years ago with this very sort of passionate interest in engaging in a magical practice. But they're coming from a very different place. And I often have to kind of really kind of dial in on, look, it's a process, not an event. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I think that that's actually a very profound distinction.
Well, I've been thinking about arcs and patterns and like long-term arcs as well. And we're now in the year of the tiger, which is a 12-year cycle, if we're speaking about the lunar new year and zodiac. And I'm thinking about 12 years ago, 2010-ish, where we had a big tiger party that I sort of organized, and we had this whole celebration of it. I'm thinking about where was I then? Where am I now? What have I done in that space in between? What were seeds that I planted 12 years ago that I'm seeing fruits of to this day? And that's how magic and engaging in these cycles of time and planetary energies really kind of work. It's like a garden, you know. You don't put a seed in the earth and it makes a fruit and then you eat it and it's done. Like, it is a whole process, and it's an organic process, and it's a long process oftentimes. And that's how I want people to, you know, encourage people to approach things oftentimes, is think about it that way. Don't think of it as this kind of poof, you stardust, bang pow, you got it. I mean, I have done magical operations where that has happened. And oftentimes, I'm trying to say oftentimes too many times. You can cut that. But I mean, those are the most profound experiences. And why don't I get into like my little bio or whatnot so I can give the listeners better context?
Yeah, please.
Sure. So I am currently writing a book on this. I don't want to get too much into that. But I realized with the pandemic, it was very much a tower card experience of just on personal levels, local levels, international levels, the whole world was just shook up. Devastation occurred. So many structures were just completely obliterated. And we were all feeling it. We're all still feeling it. And we're all still adjusting to it. And honestly, when people ask me how I'm doing, I'm like, well, that's the question of the decade. I don't know if I'm going to be able to answer that until this decade is over, because I feel like this whole decade is going to be a tower experience.
So in a way, you are acknowledging that the pandemic itself started a new cycle. And when people say to you, how are you doing? How are you handling it? You're kind of viewing it in the same way that you've been viewing magic, which is you've got to give me enough time to look back and examine how things have changed before I can really tell you how I'm doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because things will change on a dime day to day too. And I discover that every single day in my life. Today is another day in my life where I am discovering that when I woke up in the morning yesterday, I had no idea what I was experiencing by the end of the day. And sometimes those are my favorite days, when I wake up and have no idea that by the end of the day, I'm going to meet a person that's going to change my life. I'm going to be offered a job that's going to make things so much better for me. and or things are going to go completely sideways, and I'm going to have to deal with some very upsetting, traumatic, conflicting things too. And that's just how it works. That's just how it is. So with my story, though, I moved to Los Angeles in the summer of 1999, my birthday week. And I was born and raised in Austin, Texas. I feel very grateful that I was born and raised in such a creative, funky, weird town that appreciated the arts, that appreciated weird kids to a degree, like myself. And I received my college degree in theater and directing. I promptly got the hell out of Texas after that and moved to London for a year, tried to make it as an actor, failed miserably. People ask me, what'd you do in London? I say, I cried a lot. But I also really enjoyed being in an international city where I could really dig in and experience things I would never experience in Texas or even Austin, which is very eclectic. And it just so happened that I had met a girl at a LARP in Salt Lake City a couple weeks before I was, you know, had my plane ticket for London already. And it was this whole big thing, and we were playing these characters in the same clan, and we created a ritual that was Kabbalistic in nature that saved the world from the evil demon overlord. And then we had this bonding moment, and then I moved to London. But then while in London, we figured out we wanted to be together. I went to Prague. I went to Israel, where she was from. We traveled around Europe, and she lived in Los Angeles. So that's where I moved to. And if there's anything I can tell people, it is people are a lot different when you move in with them than they are as pen pals or talking on the phone.
Or even as adventure buddies.
Or even as adventure buddies, yeah. But nonetheless, I was here in L.A. I had $100 to my name in a bag. I felt like Axl Rose stepping off the bus, you know, with a piece of grass in my mouth, like ready to see be part of L.A. and all that good stuff. So within a year of moving in with her, we had broken up. I was in this renting a room somewhere that I never thought I would be. And I just prayed for something to change my life. And I went to the bus stop and got on the 33 bus, which is a number that always resonates with me. And by the end of that day, my life had changed. By the end of that day, I'd met some people that would absolutely change my life, that would open doors for me to my magical paths, to magical societies, to all sorts of strange and interesting characters. And it actually kind of dialed back to my very first couple of weeks here, where we went to a LARP once again. And it was a LARP party in the mountains of Silverado. And at this party, I met someone who would become one of my mentors, and that someone I'd be very involved with their group, because the daughter of this person who was hosting the LARP happened to be the daughter of someone who was very well known in a lot of circles and has been for 40 plus years. It was a Solomonic group. It was a group that used the grimoires, that taught ceremonial magic, but also engaged in seasonal rites. And that is really what sort of started my journey. I remember standing in front of this doorway to their temple, which was locked, but I felt the presence behind it. And it was almost very kind of Harry Potter of like, we've been waiting for you. And it was like strange that a year later, I found myself joining a fraternity to which this person belonged. And then all these pieces sort of fell into play. And long story short, I joined a very secret Golden Dawn group that did not have a website, did not advertise themselves, where it was very kind of classic, where you had to meet members and them sort of vet you and express interest, and they didn't tell who the members were. And when you joined, you didn't talk about any about that. But that set me upon my path. And I don't describe myself as a ceremonial magician, but I'm very happy that I have that background, because I went through all the stages of working up to the inner order. And I see a lot of people these days too, that kind of, and I do this myself. I'm kind of like, oh, well, magical orders is not really where it's at. It's all about your personal experience, about your personal practice. But I'm very glad that like the first thing I did was learn the Hebrew alphabet. and the planets and the zodiac. That's like the first knowledge lecture in the Golden Dawn. And I think anyone who is interested in astrology, in the tarot, would benefit from this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree. It's like the foundation of, well, I mean, I guess you could argue that cunning magic and, you know, folk magic and sabbatic witchcraft or tradcraft, it's not as important to know the Kabbalah. But it, no matter what tradition, I found that knowing, at least having a small foundation of astrology, you don't have to be able to read people's charts, but you need to know what the personal planets represent. And you're thinking, what spell, you know, or what can I do to help me regain more passion in my sex life or something? And you would automatically know that a Tuesday would be the best day, and doing something through martial type spirits would be the best way. Otherwise, you're just kind of fumbling in the dark, making guesses here and there. Or, God, the kids today have the internet, so they don't need to know. They can just say, what does peppermint represent? And look it up on the internet. There's no needing to, you know, cross-reference the Picatrix and Agrippa and Lily and trying to see, like, okay, peppermint can be these things. It's no, it's just there on the internet, and they think that's enough. But they don't get the nuance, you know, they don't get the real foundation of why peppermint can represent such and such, which to me, that magic is so much about creativity. And if you don't understand the parts that you're working with, then you cannot successfully create because you don't really know what you're working with. I mean, you can, and I definitely did successful spellcraft before I had this knowledge, but it was very hit or miss. Mm-hmm. And I have a much higher success rate now that I understand what I'm doing.
Precisely, precisely. And so one phenomenon, I'm going to get back to my story in a second, but I want to touch on this strange kind of phenomenon I see of, I mainly associate this with dating apps because this is where I see it, but it's also just in general culture. 20 years ago, you were still like a nerd if you were into these things, you know? The only space on the internet to find other people that are into the magic and such was a thing called Witch's Vox. And it was like, you'd get on there in like 2003 and be like, oh, there's someone in 100 miles away that's into this. You know, like, oh, there's like a coven in the mountains, you know, in San Diego. Cool. Or you had to hang out in shops and bookstores and meet the rare person that comes by and you kind of sort of talk to. But now I'd say like at least a third of the profiles I see, and I'm actually not that active on these apps, but they have their sun, moon, and rising listed. Not like I'm a vegetarian, not like I'm into sports, not like I'm into this type of music. It's like I'm an Aries sun and a Pisces moon and you know, a Virgo rising, right? So if I meet someone like that through a phone or if I meet them in person, they're saying these things, my first go-to is like, oh, awesome, you're a Pisces moon, what's your Jupiter? I would say 90% of the time, they have no idea. They're like, I don't know. And my response is, you should know. Like, why are you wearing this badge if you can't just earn like learning what your chart is? You know, it's just strange to me. I'm not trying to like discourage people from knowing their rising sign or their moon sign or the sun sign, but they don't seem to understand that each of these signs has a ruler and that indicates what kind of Aries they are. It indicates if they're a good Aries or they're not very good at it. And I am actually stepping into a point where I am offering tarot readings again and baking astrology into that. That's one thing I want to offer. I see a lot of people offering all sorts of cool things they specialize in. My specialty is going to be, hey, if you know your sun, moon, and rising, let's talk about your chart. Let's just get back the basics, because if you don't know that, you're still kind of fumbling around, and having a deeper appreciation of this will help you. Because if you are indeed expressing an interest in this, just go a little bit further. And we all know that, because they're, well, it's all complicated. Oh, it's so much. I'm like, no, you learned these things in elementary school. You learned what the planets were. The days of the week are literally named after the planets. Let's use that as a basis to gain some deeper understanding here. it can be daunting at first, but once you kind of realize that you've been learning this your whole life as part of Western culture, I think it makes people it easier for people to kind of step into that.
It's also just really good for self-healing, because the way that we are presented this, like, what's your top three? It's like that's supposed to describe your personality or something, right? Mm-hmm. Well, once I actually started learning astrology, learning Hellenistic astrology especially, I realized that, you know, the planets and even the rulers of my top three, sun, moon, and rising, were not the planet that was dominant in my chart. And so I'm sitting here thinking, oh, I'm ruled by Mercury because I have a Gemini ascendant, and I'm basing all of these thoughts of my self-identity around this, thinking that, you know, my Gemini ascendant was like this major statement in my chart, and then come to find out, like, I'm entirely Saturn ruled. And that really does color my Gemini ascendant, especially because Mercury is the one of those planets that wears the cloak of whoever is in charge of him. So for me to just say, oh, I'm a Mercurial person, that's actually not very true. I'm a Saturnal person who has Mercurial qualities.
Well, as a Gemini with a Virgo moon and a Mercury in Gemini with a Capricorn rising, but I have a Capricorn rising though, and it's having this like mask of lead that all my Mercurial energies have to kind of like see the world through, I can't say is the easiest thing, but nonetheless, I had to learn to embrace that. So, you know, kind of getting back to my story, I attempted to get into the whole Hollywood thing and eventually succeeded fairly well at that. And it took some time. But when I did first join this order, I actually joined various orders. I decided, like, you know what? I'm going to step away from acting or producing or whatnot and really dig into this and treat it like college, and spent a good 4 years learning all that and doing the path. And in the Golden Dawn, the Outer Order, you're actually not even supposed to practice magic.
I didn't know this.
Yeah. You engage in ceremony, but the whole thing is supposed to be this, part of it is like a purification process. Part of it is learning all the tools that you need to then join the Inner Order. And that's where you practice actual magic. That's where you actually like make talismans or summon spirits and all that kind of stuff. But the goal is to go from Malkuth to Tepharith to gain knowledge and conversation with your holy guardian angel, and to be coming from a space of a heart-centered space, as opposed to your mind or your body.
I think that is so wise. So, so wise. Because we oftentimes don't know what we want until we have achieved that rectification of like our Malkuth self with our, you know, higher self that resides in Tepharith. Mm-hmm. And then we're like doing magic to bring XYZ into our life, but maybe that is not something that we actually need in our life. And we won't really know that until we have rectified that relationship between Malkuth and Tepharith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's definitely some wisdom there. And so that's what I was doing. That's the sort of like approach that I took. Of course, in another order, we were summoning angels and grimoire spirits. And doing Enochian magic, and this is all like in 2001. You know what I mean?
Wait, so you're in one group that says please don't do magic until you get into the inner circle, and you're like, yeah, okay. While I'm in the room, but when I go into the other room, I'm gonna do what I want. Is that?
Yep.
You know, I'm okay with that. That's also very mercurial.
It is, but to give it credit, there was a lot of cross-pollinization of members here. And those of us that thought we were like the real serious magicians were like in the Solomonic group as well. And that group, though, they had something similar there too, where it was based upon Solomon. So Solomon sort of being the Santa Claus of the grimoire tradition, you know, being the figure that, you know, summoned all the restless spirits and was devoted to Asherah, Astarte, and used all the restless spirits to build the temple of God, all that great stuff, right?
Asmodee tricked him, though.
There's so many, yeah, in many traditions, he fell from grace too, eventually. But the way he's venerated in a lot of different societies is this, you know, the wisest man ever, and how he built the greatest temple on earth, and how he brought in, you know, King Hiram of Tyre and Hiram of Biff, and that goes into Masonic tradition, all sorts of stuff. But nonetheless, in this order, the first thing we did before we started doing all the kind of grimoire stuff was angelic communications and elemental attunements of sorts and pathworkings, so that we did have this, and we're using the Almadel crystal ball method to get in touch with basically angels you call upon in the LBRP. So, you know, Raphael, Mikael, Gabriel, Uriel, and those are all different operations we would do. We would do four different path workings, which were actually really brilliant and that attuned us to the elements that are all below Tepharath. So it was similar to the Golden Dawn system, but it wasn't bogged down in all this sort of Victorian claptrap. And it wasn't one of these things like, you've got to spend 3 years. It's like, no, get the angels on your side, get the powers of earth and what is composed of it as your foundation, and then start summoning all these, you know, restless spirits. Because you will have, the angels will have your back, you know.
Yeah, that's also a very wise way to do it. I see so many people start magic and immediately go to Galatia. And in my mind, that's like, you didn't even read the fucking grimoire then, because Solomon's clearly states that you're meant to make a relationship with the angels first. Mm-hmm. Like, it's literally there in the grimoire, but go off, I guess.
Yeah, and in this system too, the 72 restless spirits line up with the 72 angels, and we always would call that angel first, and then be like, hey buddy, get my back during this operation, you know, that sort of flip side.
So just correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't actually do any Solomonic operations in my own practice, but I have read the grimoire. My understanding is that the angel gives you the authority to tell the demon, like, I'm not making a pact with you. This isn't a trade. I have the authority of God and the angels on my side. And so this isn't a transaction. You are subservient to me. And I think that's another huge distinction that people who just go straight to Galatia, they're trying to make pacts with these devils or entities of denser matter spirits is how I really like to think of them. But so am I correct about that?
Yes, yes. And that's actually the whole point behind achieving conversation with your holy guardian angel. If at least one angel, if you achieve resonance and that part of you that resides in Tepharath is calling the shots, as opposed to you know your body or your emotions or things of that nature, that gives you, that places you up the food chain, that places you in the hierarchy that allows you, I don't know if necessarily call it subservient, but it creates a hierarchy of, hey, you know, we used to talk about in this way, that evocation was, that all these things are within you. Lon Duquette has some amazing descriptions of this, you know.
Low Magic is a good book. I highly recommend it.
Oh, yeah. It's great. All his books are. And he basically says we all come equipped with like 72 restless spirits that we need to kind of get under control and make them work for us. So we would talk about evocation from the level of, you know, it's in you because we're connected to everything, right? And it's taking that piece out of you and throwing it onto the black mirror and then being like, okay, you know, you're unruly and you're part of me, but you work for me. You're going to do the heavy lifting now in this regard. And then you put it back inside you, you know, and it's almost like muscles or something that you need to kind of work out and train if you want to, you know, be stronger or more dexterous or whatnot. So that, going back to my story, I went through all those processes. I went through all those processes of becoming in part of the inner order of these groups, of all the training, all that kind of stuff. And I wouldn't say I felt like I got to a dead end, but I definitely got to the point that they also speak about in the Golden Dawn tradition, which is when you join the inner order, you're essentially told that you now have all the tools, go out into the world and make your own thing with them. And that's something I don't think a lot of people think about too much, but that is what the Rosicrucian manifesto and path is supposed to be. You gain the tools to actually, you know, shape the world through magic, but now you need to go out and do your own thing without anyone else's help. And if nothing else, I think that I see a lot of good examples of people in the world who have done this, who came from that sort of GD tradition, but have created their own thing with it. Paul Foster Case is a great example. Dion Fortune is a great example. Yeats is a great example of people that took it and put their own spins on it and brought their own cultural experiences and knowledge to the table and created their own art. And my favorite people in all these sort of historical groups have been the people. You know, Jack Parsons is one of these, you know, who was kind of downstream of all this, but that nonetheless kind of did his own thing within that background of Thelema and all that. A lot of these people met tragic ends too. So, but still.
Let's talk about this though, because I think that it's a good segue into something else I know you want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So what we mentioned earlier, people want magic to be pretty, and it's oftentimes it's not. I think however much we create, it's an equal exchange. So we have to sacrifice something mm-hmm. in order to feed that creation. So mm-hmm. when you're talking about these people who revolutionized magic systems and then they met, you know, weird and tragic ends, there is a semblance of like a blood sacrifice there, even if it's not done in a way that we humans have seen, you know, we as man have seen on TV. There's no like ritual where we're willfully sacrificing this person, but the gods still claim the blood. They'll still take their sacrifice for what that's the exchange, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So do you want me to talk about sacrifice or giving things up or exchange? Because these are all components, you know?
Yeah. And I think it has to do with allowing misadventure into your life and allowing turbulence into your life and acknowledging obstacles as potentially part of the working. Instead of saying to yourself, I need to put more control, it seems to me like a lot of your approach to magic is letting go and letting the gods kind of direct it and flow it, regardless of the misadventures that may come up along the way.
Yeah, precisely. Because, well, I often talk about with others how the Mahabharata, and it's this gigantic text, a Vedic text, and it all kind of boils down to one specific spiritual teaching, though, which is Krishna talking to Arjuna, who's going to war with his uncle, and he's real upset about it because he doesn't want to fight his uncle, but nonetheless, he needs to do this sort of thing. And it's also a story, I think, about achieving the true will, if you put it in that sort of context. And the lesson basically is act without the lust for result. Be brave. Take action, but trying to like grip this one result is going to interfere with your ability to take action and succeed. And what you want to happen oftentimes isn't what is going to happen, but at least will happen, as opposed to not taking any action at all. They say you miss all the shots you never take, right? So this also kind of lines up with Zen archery, which I read that book back in high school and whatnot. And it really resonates with me. Like, take action, do it, but don't necessarily be hung up on this one little thing happening. And I find that all the most delightful, magical experiences I've had come from that place. I mean, most recently, I was in New Orleans and had a number of experiences like that. Let me dial it back to like 2005, though, just real quick. Cliff Notes version is I went to grad school. I got my master's in counseling psychology. I then decided promptly that I didn't have the sort of emotional fortitude to listen to people kind of unwind all day long, and promptly got back. And one thing we talked about is like, what's your heart's desire? Well, I love being on set. I love being part of the creative process. I love production. I love all the cast of characters involved in them. And I promptly got back into the TV film industry. And that was sort of the next stage of my life. And in this part, like my magical background was sort of a secret identity, really, because it was still a kind of stage where you were weird if you were into this. People didn't want to talk about magic around the water cooler, you know? But then this was sort of the advent of like MySpace and things like that, where then I was connecting with kindred spirits. This is where I first met my dear friends, Austin and Caitlin Kopic, which, by the way, shout out to Austin and Caitlin. Shout out to Spirit Sundry. I'm wearing your Venus oil right now, as she is now in her exalted state. And I started kind of like connecting on that level with all these kind of people who are all still very dear to me, that we were doing these things and we weren't doing them to like show off on the internet. We were doing them because we loved this life and these practices.
So such a big deal that you mentioned that, because I do feel like that period of time, like the MySpace days, were the days in which social media hadn't been so morphed into capitalism and become this weird, like, I can make a business off of this, mm-hmm. and I can become important through this. And so there was this freedom to just connect with people in a way that wasn't necessarily bogged down by the same pressures that, you know, I'm experiencing on platforms like Instagram.
Precisely. And honestly, that just makes me want to puke, if I'm just being very honest. There's nothing wrong with promoting yourself or having a business around what you are good at and what you have to offer the world. Here I am saying that, like, the end of my story here that starts with the pandemic is me realizing about 20 plus experiences of a tarot reader, astrology, magic, and like I actually feel somewhat qualified to offer these insights and whatnot to people. But what qualifies anyone these days? What I look at so many people that like a year ago got into this, you know, once these like people raised in Harry Potter that have been believing all this, and then suddenly they see people making money and they see people being successful and they're like, I'm going to do this too. And some of them are. And some of them are doing a lot better than others. And some of it is just pure glamour, I think, in some ways. You know, cool and cute and funny and all this sort of stuff. But what does this have to do with you being a, you know, expert on your occult practice that you want to like offer your services to people? I don't get that at all. It's completely over my head. Like, I'm not sure how that lines up with a spiritual teacher or practitioner that is presenting themselves as an authority on their subject matter. Yeah. And I want to stand and say that I don't necessarily consider myself authority, but I do have stories and I do have experience. And I think there is some wisdom to be gained from sharing those. And that's why I'm writing a memoir. And that's why I have a grimoire attached to the memoirs that say, like, here are things that I have done. Here's how they were successful. Try them out for yourself, you know? So back to my story, around 2012, like all hermetic orders and such, there was a big wizard war. There's all this backstabbing, all sorts of tragedy and betrayal and drama and all this kind of crap. And I basically quit everything, said, I hate groups. I don't want anything to do with this anymore. And just sort of stuck out on my own and then really started really digging in the dirt, both figuratively and literally, and woke up to this whole sort of idea, not even an idea, this acknowledgement that the spiritual world around me is so rich. And this is something I'd always known, but I hadn't quite engaged on it on the level because I didn't feel that I could. But one of the biggest things I realized was that I've been doing some folk magic stuff, but I really dug into it. I realized that I live in a city that's named after the Queen of the Angels. And I realized that my whole life I've seen Guadalupe around every corner and every Mexican restaurant you walk in, there she is with like some dollars tucked into her little shrine. And that there was millions of people in the city that I live in burning candles to the saints and to Guadalupe and all various variations of them all. And that I live in her kingdom. That she's the queen of the Americas. She's the saint of the Americas. And that was sort of a through line for me, that and Saint Cyprian, of A, helping me in my wizard battles, and also really getting in touch with the spirits of the land and the city that I live in. And that set a model for me for every city and place that I went to from there on, is first and foremost, both acknowledging my ancestors, the blood that flows through me, and the blood that flows through the land that I'm walking upon, and not approaching it as this like big badass, you know, stepping into town dude, but as like a humble traveler who is a guest in the court of these immense, powerful, revered beings. And as a bard, coming there to share tales and gain new tales and have some fun with it. So then over the course of the whole past decade too, that was a whole big journey. I produced some number one television shows. I worked on a bunch of paranormal things. I became sort of the Hollywood go-to guy for paranormal, supernatural casting, production, that sort of thing. I traveled the world, had all sorts of fun adventures in that way that I'm detailing in my book. And then with the pandemic, everything shut down. Everything was devastating. I grew a big wizard beard. And it was then that I decided to sort of plug myself back into magical personalities on the internet, because I just avoided it all for a long time. I was like, this is, except for my close friends. And that's how I met you and some other good folk in New Orleans. And I started like seeing all these faces and people that felt familiar to me. And it's sort of like, oh, well, this is in a big way my tribe. This is when I landed in LA. I wasn't at a Hollywood premiere party the first week. I was at a wizard castle, you know, in the mountains with a bunch of grimoire magicians that have been practicing for 30 plus years, and fell into that family. And that was my family for a good 12 years. And that opened so many doors for me. I'm like, this is my family. It might be dysfunctional, but I'm going to reengage in this now. And I'm going to step into that. I'm no longer going to be afraid to own this and share it.
So what I think is super interesting about that is this acknowledgement that career and like your passion do not have to go in line. They don't have to be the same thing. You can have a passion for a career type and acknowledge that family and community exists and maybe should exist outside of that. So like what you're saying is magic was your community, it was your passion, but working on set was like another kind of passion. And you didn't feel this need to superimpose the two on top of each other.
Yes. And honestly, there was this sort of fear of being ridiculed because it had happened before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the world, it's so much different now. Like everyone's into this stuff and it's a double-edged sword. And it's similar to role playing too, which is, you know, you got beat up for playing D&D when I was young and a teenager, even in college, even like 12 years ago. Like I remember dating a girl who like basically broke up with me, who was like, oh, you LARP, well, that's social suicide. I can't be seen with someone that even talks about it. And now people are millionaires from doing it, you know? Now you go to LARPs and it's like all young people that are like cool and attractive and loving it and posting it all over Instagram. And I think that's great, but it's so different than the culture was in the aughts, you know? And seeing these arcs is kind of fascinating to me. And a lot of times I think about how everyone's a LARPer now. Everyone has this, and when we talk about magical media, people have these personas, right? I mean, I have it too. If you have a profile or an avatar or things like that, you are creating this construct of how you present yourself to the world. But one of the reasons why I would like went to New Orleans and I go to other places for people I've met online is like, I want to meet this person in person. Because the construct they have online may not necessarily line up with who they are in person, or I'm just going to have a much richer experience getting to meet them. I want to look them in the eye. I don't want to look at their profile picture and these words and text. I want to engage in them on an organic level. And that's how I'm really going to know this person, know if I can trust them. So I just want to use my story of going to both New Orleans and Vegas real quick as sort of a wrap-up of what I feel is very important. If anyone's listening to this and they've just started a practice, it's very important to have indicators that you're being successful in what you're doing, right? Like Crowley said, and people use this a lot, you know, success shall be thy proof. And he's onto something there, right? So I go to Vegas every year and I go to the Bellagio amongst the other hotels because they create a giant shrine to the lunar animal of that year. This year was the tiger. But it's a great place to go, like, you know, stick little sigils and things and do stuff and basically call upon the spirit that governs that year of like, hey, like, be good to me. And people go, why do you go to Vegas to do magic? I'm like, are you kidding? It is a city built on magic. It is a city built on fortune. What better place to go do fortune enchanting than a place? And as a mercurial person, I mean, there is an absolute flow of money and currency and cultural exchange and societies and people just flowing through it every single day. And that's never going to stop. And there are a million shrines burning there to every god and spirit and whatnot that you could ever imagine. There's so much production value there, right? So I go there, I do my thing, and the Bellagio is where I do this. When I was in New Orleans too, that was when Jupiter entered Pisces, and I'm in my 12th health year, and which is ruled by Jupiter, but it's also my 12th house, which is sort of the house of exile and like everything, all the chickens coming home to roost. From my previous 12 years, it's kind of a wrap up in a lot of ways. But I wanted to be near bodies of water where my ancestors are from. That's where my grandfather's father is buried. And I did a lot of fortune enchanting on St. Cloud.
Okay, St. Cloud.
Yeah, St. Cloud. So long story short, I went to Vegas at the beginning of this month and did all the fortune enchanting at the Bellagio. Had some weird twists and turns happen there. I basically got stranded in another city and state, but within like a few hours, I figured it out through a strange coincidence of a friend that I had there that I saw on an app. It was like, hey, what are you doing in Vegas? Blah, blah, blah. And they ended up getting a ride home. And I got back just feeling all the energies of what I had done. I went to this Sekhmet temple that's in the middle of nowhere. I got a tiger tattoo and like brought it before her and like was bleeding in front of Sekhmet being like, hey, bless me in this, you know, hey, I'm bleeding for you, you know, identity thing, you know, here we are. And then the next week I got a tattoo dedicated to my Jupiterian chart placements, right? I have some fish here, all that good stuff. Cause like, I really want to like juice this while Jupiter is in Pisces. I want to like get all the good juice here, you know? So within literally 1 week after that so that was the new moon when I did all the fortune chanting. A week later, I got on a Thursday, an hour of Jupiter, all that, got that tattoo. 1 week later on the full moon, I get the call of a company I worked for before, like, hey, we have this spot open at this one mega mansion on the top of Bel Air. Do you want to come work there? And I went and checked it out. I'm like, hell yeah. Because one thing I did during the pandemic was get my guard card because all production had shut down. And I never thought I'd be like a bouncer or security guard at the end of all this. But here I am. You know, we got to pay the bills. So here I am, 2 weeks after in the process of doing all this fortune enchanting, 2 months out from being in New Orleans and doing stuff by the water and all this kind of stuff. And I am strolling around now at basically Mount Olympus of Los Angeles. I am working at the most opulent, extravagant, expensive mega mansion in America. I'm not exaggerating. It is where Jupiter and Juno would live if they lived anywhere in the world, basically. It has 42 bathrooms. It has a bowling alley and a nightclub. It is surrounded by water. I stand at the top of all this and gaze out in the most amazing view I've ever seen of Los Angeles. I watch birds at the very tip tops of these very tall trees. And it's something that very, very few humans in this world, I think, will ever experience or see. And that's where I'm just kind of strolling around. I mean, I'm working, but I'm in this space that is nothing but Jupiterian in many ways. And so the funny thing here is, the entrance to Bel Air, which has this big stone archway, and Bel Air is this huge, strange labyrinth too. I've gotten lost many times by just taking the wrong, weird, curvy road. It's Bellagio Way. Just yesterday, too, the company I work for, like, hey, we need you to kind of fill in this other mansion down the street. Well, guess what that location is called?
What is it?
St. Cloud.
Oh, wow. No way.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, some people be like, oh, well, that's all coincidence. But it's also very, very, very specifically the two places I've done the most fortune enchanting in the past since Jupiter went into Pisces.
Yeah. I don't think that that's a coincidence. That's a synchronicity in my mind.
Well, I think it's a manifestation of my fortune enchanting magic is that I went and engaged with the spirits of these places and they have resonance in other places too. And the universe or whatever you want to call it is kind of echoing back to me specifics of what I did as sort of signposts of, hey, this is working. I can't say this is exactly where I want to be in the world, but I do also want time to write. And I have been given that as part of this process and these amazing, opulent, magnificent places in which I can engage in that, which are very inspiring and it's a font of creativity and whatnot. And it just makes me kind of laugh. And that's what I'm saying, like the joys of misadventure. I just sometimes just want to pinch myself. I'd literally pinch myself when I was standing up there at the tippy top of LA. And this is like a James Bond villain mansion. It's bonkers. And it's just all kind of funny.
Do they pay well?
Not really. But I have time to write my book.
Yeah. So it's expansion and abundance in other ways. And
yeah. But I mean, I think right now it's very present for me. You know, it's how do you, like, previously I was working a job as a bouncer in this big fancy pants place in LA too, but I really had to be on my toes because I had to like herd drunk people all the time. Like, you're not going to be able to just sit there and have all this space to kind of like think about things and write some notes down here and there while still doing your job. That was very like, I have to be vigilant at all times. This kind of gives me the space to just kind of sit and dwell and compose things while doing my job. If that makes sense.
No, definitely. And that is a godsend.
Yes. So I'm just using that as one example. And I hope people take it as a means of like, oh, okay, those are very, very specific sort of answers to a call.
I also think that that's such so wise to point out about the land spirits sometimes having a resonance in a different location. I've never considered that before, but that made so many light bulbs go off in my head.
They do. And, or is it even just like complete sort of chaos magic of like, these are the places and names that I called upon and they don't belong to just one place, like names of power, you know, that I specifically called upon. I am now seeing these names every time I go to work. And I'm literally traveling these paths that were named after them in other places, but they are being answered here. Because I didn't go to Vegas or New Orleans to like have a bunch of good fortune there. I mean, I did while I was there, but that's not where I live. Like, you got to take that stuff back home with you.
Here's something that I thought was cool about your story of coming to New Orleans, if you don't mind me sharing.
Go for it.
So when you were coming down here, you were kind of like, I can't really afford this trip, but I'm going to do it anyway. Then you get here and you do just kind of run through the rest of your spending money, basically. And then while you're here, you get a phone call from your friends being like, we will fly you out to our house and put you up and like take care of you for however long, if you lead a D&D group for us that week. And I thought that that was very much like you just being like so fucking brave that you would just be like, I know that going on this trip could put me in a financially poor position, but I trust my magic. I trust my spirits. I feel like I'm being pulled there for a reason. And then you were absolutely taken care of. Like, it did work out that way. And that to me is so inspiring because it's a level of bravery that I personally am still trying to work at. Like, I get told by my spirits all the time, stop trying to focus on making your career happen. Focus on us and we'll do the rest. But when we live in this world of scarcity and capitalism, I feel like that is so, like, that's a fucking leap of faith right there. And you embody that leap of faith in your life so well that, yeah, like, I view you as an inspiration in that way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I do want to use these stories as examples of doing that, because you really got to feel like you deserve these things in order to claim them. I talked to a lot of people about this sometimes too, where like, I see people, they get in the magic, they want all these things, but their mind and their insecurities and their doubts and fears, which we all have, are constantly steering the wheel of the ship in the direction of those things. And I have a great example of a good friend of mine that lived with me for a while, who I was teaching some magical stuff, and he had some good, but we were walking down the street and a black cat walks out, doesn't cross our path. And this is like during the pandemic too. So everything's all miserable and horrible. And there's a black cat and it kind of hovers there. And we both stop on our feet like, uh-oh. And it see, and I kind of do this sort of like, wait, this Jedi wave of like, these aren't the droids you're looking for. I don't say it, but I kind of do this sort of like, and the cat stops and turns around and goes back into the bushes where it came from. And my instant reaction was, and I didn't express this, my instant reaction was like, here is a great sign. I don't like using the word universe, but here's a great sign from the world or whatever, our nature spirits here, of like, although it looks like bad fortune is coming our way, if we have a good attitude, it'll turn around and it's not actually going to happen. And we take a step and the first thing my friend says is, just watch, you know, that cat's going to run back across our path and curse us when we get to that place. And I'm just like, man, this is what I'm talking about, dude. You can't always be like we literally just got shown bad fortune, as what people consider it, turning around and going the opposite direction and not crossing our path. And here you are turning it into, it's going to fuck us anyway. It's going to screw up our lives anyway. I'm like, that is why your magic's not working, dude.
So people often like to associate Jupiter as seen as optimistic, but I think that this is an apt example of Mercury as the magician card, right? Mercury as Magus, because what does the Magus card represent on a mundane level? It represents that my words manifest, whatever I speak out loud becomes my reality.
Yes.
But there is, and I'm not saying mercurial people are optimistic by definition, but mercurial people understand that their words have power, and that if they can redirect their pessimism into optimism, they have a better chance of manifesting what they want.
Precisely, precisely. And you know, it's funny because way back in the day, when I'm talking about the early aughts here, and people in these orders, like we were studying NLP, things of that nature, which place a heavy emphasis on your words and how to construct them and how to manifest with them. Also in the counseling psychology program that I went through, part of the process of bringing people through is like recognizing where you're kind of tripping yourself up, recognizing where things can be challenging, but the idea of reframing, right? Where, okay, how do I take this and make it better? How do I reframe this as, how do I reframe this challenge as an opportunity for growth and learning, as opposed to woe is me, my life sucks, and, you know, steering it in that direction. And you're absolutely correct in that regard. And that's something, I have a friend that I've sort of been counseling and saying like, look, you know, I'm just going to repeat your words back to you. And I constantly hear you saying like, I'll be like, hey, you're talking about this right now. And it's all you ever talk about. And you're basically crying when you talk about it. But I keep, and every time I say, well, how do you, the response is, I know, but it's hard. I know, but it's hard. It's hard for me to do that. I'm like, well, but you keep reinforcing that it's hard. How about just pay attention for a second to what you're saying and acknowledge, like, I know this is hard, but I'm going to take steps to, you know, add on that thing of like, I'm going to take steps to making this less hard. I'm going to take, I know it's hard, but I'm going to recognize this as a place for growth and healing and step into that instead of just stepping into this is hard, this is defeating me. Trust me, this is a week that I'm having. The Saturn Mars conjunction has been hard. I'm dealing with some really heavy shit right now. And part of me did not want to wake up and do this podcast today. And part of me went, no, I'm going to push through this and see where it goes. Because it's one of those things where, it's one of those things too, where you catch yourself being like, you know, I'm going to be 48 in 2 months. And a lot of people will say things like, well, if I do this 2-year process, I'm going to be 50 at the end of it. And the thing is, you're going to be 50 at the end of it in 2 years, one way or the other. So are you going to be 50 at the end of it and have earned your degree? or written your book and all that kind of stuff? Or are you going to just be 50 of it and not have any of those things? It's going to happen one way or the other. You got to accept that time marches on. So what are you going to, how are you going to piece all that out? You know, it's funny with Jupiter is like, yeah, I kind of focus on the mercurial stuff, honestly. And going back to that phone call I got, it was really cool because it was my friends, the Copics, who are doing very successful, and they're up in Oregon. And we had this D&D group back in the day. And the funny thing is, I was actually in Austin, Texas. I basically went to Austin for Christmas the day between my two New Orleans trips. I kind of bookended it. And it was Christmas Day, and I was in Austin. And I went and saw an old friend that I hadn't seen in 20 years, and I looked at her chart. And this is one thing I want to offer to people. This is when I point out things really quick. She had like the worst chart ever. But then I'm like, how is this person? I show up at their place, and it's this big, fancy, opulent house. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh, that's crap. Oh, yeah, that's this detriment. That's an awful placement, blah, blah, blah. And this is me caprising, shooting it straight. I'm like, oh, there it is. You have Jupiter in Cancer. And I go, you know, I have a friend that has Jupiter in Cancer. And that's Jupiter's best placement. And that friend is Austin Kopic. And he called me hours later and was like, hey, you want to come out to Oregon and during Venus and Mercury retrograde, like go back to that D&D campaign we had 12 years ago, right before Jupiter, Neptune entered Pisces, and like kind of like, you know, have that as like a fun retrograde experience. And part of me had planned on like going back to LA and hitting the ground running. But I was like, nope, this is what Jupiter and other things want me to do. And actually, it was very refreshing for me. It was, and I had to once kind of take that leap of faith too, because like, well, I'm not gonna be earning money, but I went and had a great time, and it was wonderful to see them. I cherish my friends dearly. I'm so happy for what they're doing, and I recommend both of their services. But then I also reconnected with some other old friends there, and it was really cool. And I was able to do some kind of cool magic out in the woods of Oregon. And the last day I was there too, which is funny because I missed my flight in the smallest airport in America. This is more misadventure because I had a I was trying to finish this Tolkien book, and I had an old you know, the card you have to get through all the for your you know what gate you're supposed to go to. I had that as a bookmark. I think it was one from New Orleans in my book. And when I went through all the x-rays and stuff, I picked up the wrong one and I went to the wrong gate. This place literally has like four gates, but like I was on one side of the airport, and it just so happened that this is also a flight going to Los Angeles. So I walk in, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm at this gate. This is a flight to Los Angeles, and I'm sitting there. And then when I try to get on it, they're like, you're on the wrong flight, buddy. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the wrong airline. Like, how do you do that? How do you do that? In such as, I don't know. So anyway, I missed my flight. But one thing I wanted to do while I was there, which I hadn't yet, is explore all these little small towns all around where they live. And so I stayed one extra night. They were gracious enough to let me do that. And a person I had met there brought me around all these small towns while I was there. Because I'm actually considering, like, this might be a cool place to plant some other roots.
It's gorgeous there.
It is. It's basically like wine country. It is wine country in Oregon. You know, I went and had this fancy dinner in Ashland, all this kind of stuff. And that next day I woke up feeling kind of scared, feeling like, oh man, what's going to become of me? I need to earn some money now. And I got a call that was like, hey, this security job is starting up. It's not the one I'm at now, but it's very similar to the story I have about going to Vegas and doing all that fortune chanting and then getting the call. Because then I was working at this one place where I'm guarding the strange gate, this liminal space, and where I'm making weird offerings to the gates and stuff. But also knowing like this isn't where I want to be because it's an hour drive and it cost me $600 in gas last month. I was like, I need to change places. And once I put that out there, and once I went to Vegas, it was like, hey, shake it up for me, peoples, you know. It got shaken up, and I got that call on the full moon, and now I'm working at Mount Olympus.
So, I love this.
But I appreciate you bringing up that story because I did have to go to New Orleans. Is something I really wanted to do, and I've been wanting it for years and years and years, and I had to take that leap of faith. And One of the things I actually wanted to talk to you about was, I know we're limited in time here, but like, what's your favorite card in the tarot deck?
Me?
Yes.
Oh, geez. I really love the Star card.
Okay.
She's probably my favorite. But I'm also an Aquarius moon. Mm. I wonder sometimes if, you know, what we're drawn to in the tarot are the things that we feel like embody us,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I can see that. I love that card too. That's one of my, I'd say one of my top fives. My favorite is the Fool. And I know that's kind of like, that's a very kind of like, you know, I like pizza kind of choice, but.
I feel like most people don't like the Fool because they think that the Fool is scary. Like that the idea of embodying the Fool's energy is very scary for most people.
Wow. No, for me, that is perfectly natural. And I look at all the major arcana, and the Fool to me seems like the only one that's happy.
You're not wrong.
Right? I mean, like, you look at the Fool and that person's happy. And then because you look at the Magician, and I like that that's the progression there, though. It's like you've got that, then you've got the Magician, and then you've got the High Priestess, then you've got the Empress. But they all look kind of serious, you know, or downright mean or grumpy or something. And the Fool is the only one that looks happy. So for me, when I think about it, I was like, he's the one person that's happy. And it's also, you know, it's Aleph, right? It's that breath of the initial breath of creation of air. And, you know, I'm an air sign, if you want to talk about my sun. And, you know, what is in a circle, right? Because the Fool is the zero, right? What's in a circle? I ask people this. What's in a circle?
Empty space.
Yes. Nothing. And that is why the Magicians cast a circle. And like in ceremonial magic, oftentimes it's banish, invoke, banish, right? But what that really means is you cast the circle and you clear it out so that there's nothing there. And within that nothingness is the potential for all things. But when you do magic, you want to be specific. So you cast the circle and then you call in you have to be very specific. Don't just kind of throw it out there. Because the more loose ends you give to the spiritual world in your magic, the more loose ends will kind of start unraveling things, honestly. And that's one thing I had to learn is don't be like, oh, you know, I want money. And then you get in a car crash and they're like, here's some money. You know, don't do that.
I know people that's happened to.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a classic
scary
story. Yeah.
Scary well, to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why you look at like, you look at the Orphic hymns, you look at grimoires. There's the people that wrote a lot of these were very smart. They ask for all this cool stuff, but then they tack on, but don't hurt me. And like do this in a harmonious fashion and do this in a healthy way.
The Picatrix has some of the best ones. Like I'm thinking about Jupiter. It's not exactly like what you're talking about, but in the Jupiter Picatrix invocation, it says, and please grant me abundance in all the ways that are beneficial to me that I have forgotten to mention.
Yeah. 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 Also, you know, tack on like, you know, give me more than I need because you may need to pay your bills and you may need to pay rent and you may need to eat, but don't you want to like do other stuff? So like what we want and what we need are two different things, and how we enjoy our lives is so much more than our basic needs, you know? And of course we want our basic needs met. And I'm kind of in that space right now where I have to meet my basic needs, and it's a humbling process, and it's a space I've been in before. So I'm accepting of it, you know, but I also need to write this book. And I need space and time to do that. And I've sort of been given this Two of Coins kind of shuffle of like, all right, you're having your needs met and it's kind of difficult. But the other currency you're getting is time and space to do it. And that's a currency in itself. And that's the mercurial thing, currency. That's one time when I was in Vegas, I was walking around seeing all these you know, all the people playing in the casino and all the currency flowing all around me. And I felt the spirits of all this. I was like, man, like, is that something that like spirits first taught man is the nature of currency and exchange and how important that is in a spiritual, magical, and just practice with other humans. Like there needs to be reciprocity. There needs to be exchange. You know, really the only thing that is kind of free is love, right? To let that flow through you. But in all other things, like our cells, the way our cells work, it's an exchange. It's a currency of energies and eating and digesting and getting rid of stuff. Most of the universe functions on currency of some way. And I think that the first magicians understood this. And I think that's why we have the magician card as what comes once you have the zero and you have that cleared space. Because then we go to the magician who has all his tools in front of him and he is calling down and directing precisely what they want in that space. You know, and from that opens the doors to the mysteries with the high priestess. And from that then creates, you know, the luscious garden of abundance and luxury and opulence, which is the empress, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, Chris, I think that's very wise and profound. And I want to thank you so much for sharing all of that with us. I definitely feel like I've learned a lot. I'm going to sit and meditate on what you just said about currency. I feel like I had some tingles go off in my brain that's like, pay attention to this. Think about this on your own time and, you know, get back to us. Cool. Okay.
Cool. Well, I've had a wonderful time talking. You know, we could probably rattle on about all these sort of things forever. And I very much appreciate you giving me the space to take up most of the space in this conversation.
That's what this is for. I wanted to hear from you.
Cool.
All right, Chris. Well, this has been an absolute joy. I love you as a person and a friend, and I appreciate all this wisdom that you have provided, and I'm sure we'll talk soon.